Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Welcome back. It is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And as we appeal to heaven, we need to continually learn, pray, and the most important is act, because power does not become, or knowledge does not become power until that knowledge is acted upon. Now, as we look at the campaign of holding people accountable, this is why the two of these kind of go along. Right, your campaign begins now, and we need to start holding accountable every public servant, because that's the whole point of your campaign. And gee, would golly, Wally, wouldn't it be great if we just had an institution within government or somebody? It'd be somebody's job to just make sure that every public servant is honoring their oath of office. Wouldn't that just be swell? So anyway, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And hopefully everybody enjoyed the little beaver sub-reference. But anywho, leave it to Beaver.
Yes.
Anyway. All right. So we were kind of covering this really interesting debate of how Madison kind of all of a sudden threw this wrench in and realized that by going down this path, maybe everybody at the table might have been agrarian and might have had the paradigm, but they were completely ignoring this growing movement in America, this textile and manufacturing. So that was interesting. Now what we want to do is we want to dive into what Governor Morris said. Go ahead. Are you ready? Go ahead.
Just Governor Morris seconded the motion.
Uh-huh. Keep going.
Okay.
Yep.
Seconded the motion on the questions for striking out landed.
Okay. And so, yay, 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 only one no, and the rest were yay. So in other words, the idea died. In other words, that thing they threw on the walls, you know, quickly fell to the floor, and they said, you know, that's not a good idea. And I think Madison was the one that reeled in everybody to help them understand, you know, America and the whole world was beginning to shift. When did the Industrial Revolution begin? Well, which one? Because the first Industrial Revolution really started in the 1800s. As a matter of fact, I pointed out on one of my shows how the 1700s was when the Industrial Revolution actually started beginning in England, and where they were actually going down this path. Now, most people do not know America's nefarious nature of violating copyright laws and intellectual property. As a matter of fact, we had people would leave Britain knowing the details of a design working for somebody or something like that. And they would bring that detail to America and they would start manufacturing or basically integrating these designs into the manufacturing process, into the products, what have you. Did you know that?
Mm-mm.
Okay. So in the Constitution, we know that Congress has the power to create, you know, patents for limited times to protect, you know, those inventors. In other words, in Britain, they already started doing that. And America wanted to do that to help induce this. But we were very open-armed with stealing Britain's technologies or those things that were being done in Britain and in Europe, period. So most people didn't know that. And that's one of the reasons why we started getting a leg up on them. And we started becoming...
I can't remember. Why only limited time?
So to ensure that things didn't maintain... So if you protected a copyright or a patent for a lifetime, indefinitely, then there would be no... I mean, that person... You're basically handing a person a monopoly on the manufacturing of an item.
I see.
Okay. And so most people feel that monopolies aren't good, especially when they're government protected. If it is a natural monopoly, because you're maintaining that monopoly because nobody can compete with you, not because they can't afford it. Alcoa is my stellar example of this. Alcoa, in manufacturing and producing aluminum product, a refined product for manufacturing by, Aero industries and all these other industries, foil and so forth. Alcoa was a monopoly, but it was not government protected. And so what ended up happening was all of these companies, DuPont, the rest of these big manufacturing companies, tried to come in and they just couldn't penetrate the market because mining and processing aluminum was a lot different than steel and everything else. And Alcoa had perfected a lot of the processes to a point where they kept on lowering the cost of aluminum. And when everybody started seeing that, they go, well, shoot, we can't even afford to compete with these guys because they're making it impossible to compete with them because we can't afford to get into the manufacturing because they keep on improving it. And the cost of aluminum was going down, 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 down. And it became a very desirable product to start integrating into alloys and into different types of things. And so these companies went to the government and said, this is not fair. You need to demand that Alcoa fix their price high enough to where we can start competing with them. Do you hear what I just said? So in other words, this was a perfect monopoly because it was serving the public and the people best. And these corporations basically went to the government and said, we need you to reach in and mandate that they make their product more expensive so we can get in and start competing with them.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a perfect monopoly when it is not protected by government and it maintains, this complete unfair advantage because they just keep doing business right. That, my friends, is a perfect monopoly. It's a good monopoly. We as a society would be better off if we actually had people doing those things. And I say that because all they're doing is they're improving their processes, bringing processes down, and so forth. I mean, Alcoa was a stellar company. They're still a stellar company for the most part, but they got destroyed because of the government or what they were doing. So anyway, all right, let's keep going down. So Carol moved to strike out having unsettled accounts and seconded the motion. So next thing you know, the landed and then unsettled accounts. And so it goes on and goes on. So let's go ahead and jump down to Mr. Wilson.
Okay. Mr. Wilson was for striking them out. They put too much power in the hands of the auditors who might combine with rivals and delaying settlements in order to prolong the disqualifications of particular men. We should consider that we are providing a constitution for future generations and not merely for the peculiar circumstances of the moment. The time has been and will be and will again be when the public safety may depend on the voluntary aid of individuals which will necessarily open accounts with the public, and when such accounts will be characteristic of patriotism. Besides, a partial enumeration of cases will disable the legislature from disqualifying odious and dangerous characters. Mr. Okay. Langdon, yep, was for ahead. Striking out the whole clause for the reasons given by Mr. Wilson. So many exclusions, he thought, too, would render the system unacceptable to the people. Mr. Gary, if the arguments used today were to prevail, we might have a legislature composed of public debtors, pensioners, placemen and contractors. He thought the proposed qualifications would be pleasing to the people. They will be considered as a security against unnecessary or undue burdens being imposed on them. He moved to add pensioners to the disqualified characters, which was negative.
In other words, they didn't even want to do that. So they started going backing out from, you know, trying to regulate a standard and or a character of public service. Interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so as we move forward, we start looking at this admission of new states. And so if we go down to page, what is this? This is page 248. It is on, what is it, Saturday? Okay, so we had Tuesday, July 26th, and then we go through. I don't see anything until Monday, August 6th. Now, I didn't realize there was this gap, and I don't think that the gap itself is what I would say in the paper. I think what ended up happening, these are the Federalist Papers, right? Or actually, no, these aren't the Federalist Papers. What I'm saying is I think that the gap in Madison's notes is a point in time where Madison was sick, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So what I have to do is I have to kind of go back and kind of look at all of that. But nevertheless, let's dive into what follows in the admission of new states. Because as we kind of look at this up above, they start talking about this. And this is where they start actually talking about the apportionment of how they're going to break down a set number of representatives to the different states. So go ahead and start with this. Now, this is actually coming from, I believe, who's speaking here? It's Mr. Butler.
So admission of new states, section 4, is that where we're at?
So actually, this is the admission of new states, and it starts off with 8, resolved that in the original formation of the legislature of the United States. So it's up above that. It's above Monday. Okay. There you go. There's two little notes, admission of states and admission of states. So go ahead.
Okay. Resolve that provisions ought to be made for the admission of states lawfully arising within the limits of the United States, whether from a voluntary junction of government in territory or otherwise, with consent of a number of voices in the national legislature less than the whole. Resolved that a Republican form of government shall be guaranteed to each state and that each state shall be protected against foreign and domestic violence.
Okay, now read the admission of states above that. If you go in the navigation campaign, there are two admissions of states. This is admission of new states. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Resolved that the original formation of the legislature of the United States, the first branch thereof, shall consist of 65 members, of which number New Hampshire shall send 3, Massachusetts 8, Rhode Island 1, Connecticut 5, New York 6, New Jersey 4, Pennsylvania 8, Delaware 1, Maryland 6, Virginia 10, North Carolina 5, South Carolina 5, and Georgia 3. But as the present situation of the states may probably alter in the number of their inhabitants, the legislature of the United States shall be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives, and in case any of the states shall hereafter be divided or enlarged by addition of territory, or any two or more states united, or any new states created within the limits of the United States, the legislature of the United States shall possess authority to regulate the number of representatives in any of the foregoing cases upon the principle of their number of inhabitants according to the provisions hereafter mentioned, namely, provided always that representation ought to be proportioned according to direct taxation and in order to ascertain the alteration in the direct taxation, which may be required from time to time by the changes in the relative circumstances of the states.
Okay, so what jumps out here is this particular line that says, the legislature of the United States shall possess authority to regulate the number of representatives in any of the foregoing cases upon the principle of their number of inhabitants according to the provisions hereafter mentioned, namely, provided always that representation ought to be proportioned according to direct taxation, and in order to ascertain the alteration in the direct taxation, which may be required from time to time by the changes in the relative circumstances of the states. And then they go into this next result. That's not what they put in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
They realized that they needed to create a fixed number. That, and they knew that if they go down the path of building a capital for serving the Union, that the capital would only last as long as, you know, those seats weren't over-occupied. In other words, they only had so many seats that they were going to be able to put in the floor of the physical design of the capital. So they built that capital to sustain the growth of America, which actually met their requirements all the way into the 1900s. So over a century and a half almost. Technically, I think it went to the Reapportionment Act was in 1929. So it was over a century that they were able to fulfill the representation of people by 30. Actually, if I remember correctly, they started, you know, finagling it right after the century. So they started playing around with that number. And then when the states never kind of looked and go, hold on here, and we the people never challenged, hey, what the heck are you doing? They said, you know what, we can get away with whatever we want to do. And that's when they came out with the Reapportionment Act, which, again, this is language in the Constitution in Article 1, Section 2, or Article 1, Section 1, I think, if I remember correctly, but regardless, it's in the immutable part. In other words, Congress cannot go and create any type of change to the language of that part of the Constitution. So just to confirm, it is Article 1, Section 2. So when we kind of look at what they were laying out in this plan, they were actually going to let Congress go ahead and, you know, play around with it so that they could, you know, they could make it up as they go along. Well, now that we have 1 million people being represented by one person, the real question is, do you feel like you're being adequately represented? And the truth is no, there's no way, especially when it comes to fighting wars. They have assumed way more power than they ever deserved or they should ever have. And bottom line, if we peel back government, we can peel back their income. We can peel back the amount of time government takes from them and takes from us, because it's taking our lives. It's taking our wealth. It is taking our liberty so that these guys can play more and more and just mess with our heads and our lives. That's what they're doing. So, okay, so it was important to kind of read that, because they maintained this. This is the second time I've seen this kind of language where they were going to be able to regulate that. That's not how it ended up, folks. Okay, so as we go down a little bit further in the next day, and actually, while you were doing that, I was looking at the documents, all of the different documents of Madison's notes, and there's literally a void from July 26th to August 6th. Now, I'm not sure if they had to have a break where everybody had to go and get ready for harvest or what have you, but there was this break, whether Madison was sick or what. The bottom line is, I know that Madison, during the ratification debates, he did not show up for a few days. I think it was almost a week that he missed because he was sick. And so those things happen. And so we now turn down to the electors. Let's look at how the language of the electors was shaping up. Go ahead and read that under Mr. Rutledge.
Section 1, the members of the House of Representatives shall be chosen every second year by the people of the several states comprehended within this union. The qualifications of the electors shall be the same from time to time as those of the electors in the several states of the most numerous branch of their own legislatures.
Now, to be fair, they've interchanged this usage of the word elector as a position as well as for the voters. And I've noticed that many states utilize that same language, electors, for their voters, when we should really be using the electorate as the voters. But anyhow, let's dive down to the admission of new states. Let's look at the language of Section 4. Go ahead.
As the proportions of numbers in different states will alter from time to time, as some of the states may hereafter be divided, as others may be enlarged by addition of territory, as two or more states may be united, as new states will be erected within the limits of the United States, the legislature shall, in each of these cases, regulate the number of representatives by the number of inhabitants according to the provisions hereinafter made at the rate of one for every 4,000.
40,000. There you go. So in other words, that was the rate that they were creating now. So, okay, let's look. If we go to the end of July, maybe this was a bunch of real work being done in the subcommittees to where they didn't meet as a body of the whole to kind of talk about what's going on. Because what we just looked at in the admission of the new states, we were actually looking at the formation of the Constitution by these sections and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. And now what we're looking at on now August 6th, what we're seeing is the admission of new states popping up in Section 4. Now, this is in Article 1, Section 4, right? And they're mentioning the admission of new states, but they're also including in the language the limitation on representation that would be fixed for 40,000. Now, if you go down underneath that, because again, Mr. Rutledge is reading all this, what they're framing as the Constitution is starting to take form now, okay? And so read the next part of the admission of new states. This is in, it looks like this is Article 20. Or
27.
No, not 27, 17. Oh. That's 17. Oh,
okay. New states lawfully constituted or established within the limits of the United States may be admitted by the legislature into this government, but to such admission, the consent of 2/3 of the members present in each house shall be necessary. If a new state shall arise within the limits of any of the present states, the consent of the legislatures of such state shall be also necessary to its admission. If the admission be consented to, the new state shall be admitted on the same terms with the original states. The legislature may make conditions with the new states concerning the public debt, which shall be then subsisting.
Okay. Now I'm going to read, because that's really new language. It's completely new language from what they've talked about before. Now it requires 2/3 of both houses, and they can create these different terms as they go along. In other words, okay, well, we really need you in the union, so we're going to, you know, give you everything. But, you know, Texas, you'd offer us nothing. And so we're going into break here. So didn't see that coming. But anyway, at least you weren't reading. And so when we come back, I'll finish what I was saying about this language, because what I was going to do is I'm going to actually read the end results of what the Constitution actually says in the admission of new states. Because Congress does not have any power whatsoever to actually play around with the sovereignty of a state. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so usually when we go into break, Tammy doesn't hear much of what I say. So she happens to really luck out not to have to hear me. anyway, I'm not sure if you heard, but what's really important is we give a good contrast to how the states were to be admitted in this version in August 6th. The version of the Constitution that they were creating at this point, they still had this idea that they were going to be able to play around with the sovereignty of a state. Now, I'm going to read it again because not that you didn't do a good job. You did a great job. I'm going to just read it to go back and forth. Right. New states lawfully constituted or established within the limits of the United States may be admitted by the legislature into this government, but to such admission, the consent of 2/3 of the members present in each house shall be necessary. So that right there is a interesting caveat, that it would require 2/3 of both houses, not just a popular vote. If a new state shall arise within the limits of any one of the present states, the consent of the legislatures of such states shall also be necessary to its admission. Now, that language is the same as the what we have. If the admission be consented to, the new states shall be admitted. Now, if the admission of one that's coming out of an existing state or an all new state together, in other words, if a new state is being admitted, the new states shall be admitted on the same terms with the original states, but the legislature, the Congress, may make conditions with the new states concerning the public debt, which shall be then subsisting, which means that they can now play around with the money and or their sovereignty to say, you know what, we're going to take some land from you or what have you regarding the public debt. Now, this is what the Article 4 says. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of another state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislature of the states concerned as well as of the Congress. Nothing, no mention of 2/3. The Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory, not the state, the territory before it becomes a state, or the property belonging to the United States. And nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. In other words, when that state becomes a state, the United States cannot make a claim towards any of its lands that would prejudice it against the state coming into the Union. In other words, if you understand what that line says, nothing in this Constitution shall so be construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any of the particular state, of any particular state.
meaning that the United States can't play around with their land, and the state can't play around with that other state's land or their own land, or I should say the United States' land. Now, here's the thing. When they put this all together, there's this one little clause in Article 1, Section 8 that basically says any and all land within a state must be purchased by the approval of the state legislature. So in other words, if they're going to have a fort, a magazine, an arsenal, shipyard, or needful building within a state, for the federal government to possess and occupy it, they actually have to pay for it with the consent of that state legislature. So in other words, when a new state is formed and they're not going to have full sovereignty, or let's say they want to have a magazine, or no, actually they're going to assume full sovereignty, but let's say they want to have a magazine, arsenal, fort, what have you, then, and it's going to be a federal fort for, you know, federal defense or what have you, then they actually have to go to the state and say, we want to maintain this fort that we created and we're going to have to pay you for it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So what this is what ended up happening. And but what we already saw is they had this little caveat at the end, but the legislature may make conditions with the new states. In other words, Congress, when they say legislature, that means Congress. That's the national legislature, may make conditions with the new states concerning the public debt with which shall be then subsisting. In other words, now that they, you know, let's say they went into debt like the Louisiana Purchase and bought that land and said, no, you owe a part of that debt. Actually, they don't. Based on the Constitution, they don't. That is a general debt that is basically shared. So the only thing that happens is when they come into the Union, they'll receive their apportionment of taxation, and that's it. Because the debt will be based or baked into that apportionment tax. Does that not make sense? That's how the rest of the states are paying it. So why would this state have to deal with anything different? So this concept of equal footing is huge. Even in August, they were still struggling with giving states their full sovereignty. That's the whole point of why this is, because now we're at August 6th, okay? Okay, and then the 13th article, the United States shall guarantee to each state a republican form of government and shall protect each against foreign invasions and on the application. Now, they said foreign invasions. Now it actually just says invasion.
Mm-hmm.
So why not foreign invasion? Why just invasion? Because let's say a state actually seceded and, you know, we consider them Americans. Would we consider them foreign?
Yeah, no.
So the point was, is they actually they deliberately went down this path of creating this general idea that people that are coming here for whatever reason, bypassing our process of immigration, just sneaking across the border, that would be considered an invasion and they will not allow it. Now, they don't even use the words repel here yet, but that's coming. But again, this is August 6th, and we're starting to see the Constitution literally being formed by, you know, the committees as they're working and chewing and working. And you know, oh, well, that's really sticking up there. Everybody's kind of liking that. That's, well, hey, that's getting better. So as we move along, and let's see, let's dive down again. And there's this one little short line. We're down on page 263. This is Governor Morris, and it's the electors. If you go down to where the electors in the navigation pane is, you know, it's just three lines. You see it? If you don't, I'll go ahead and read it. So this is what basically Mr. Governor Morris said this. He moved to strike out the last member of the section beginning with the words qualifications of electors, close quote, in order that for other provision might be substituted, which would restrain the rights of suffrage to the freeholders. So they were actually talking about a federal
control or a federal qualification for people to be able to vote in the federal elections. That's what that electors meant. Again, it was kind of interchangeable between this role of those who choose the president and the voters. This is why I'm here to tell you using electorate would be a lot easier to understand what they're talking about, the electorate being the voter. Let's go down a little bit further. Mr. Ellsworth then pipes in on the electors. What does he say?
Mr. Ellsworth thought the qualifications of the electors stood on the most proper footing. The right of suffrage was a tender point and strongly guarded by most of the state constitutions. The people will not readily subscribe to the national constitution if it should subject them to be disenfranchised. The states are the best judges of the circumstances and temper of their own people.
Okay, so if you really look at what they were having to consider, they wanted to make sure that the Constitution was not going to be bitter for the people to taste. In other words, you know, hey, we want to only make it for, you know, the pompous, you know, pretentious, you know, people out there that think they're better than everybody. Well, they are. So what they wanted to do was they wanted to make, they by the divine hand of providence, they actually were creating a government that was the that had the greatest appeal to the common man, as well as the security in protecting the common man from the rich man. Okay, so as we go down a little bit further, we talk about property and representation. This becomes a very decent discourse or discussion or debate. So Mr. Dickinson from Delaware leads us off with this. And this is, go ahead.
Mr. Dickinson had a very different idea of the tendency of vesting the right of suffrage in the freeholders of the country. He considered them as the best guardians of liberty and the restriction of the right to them as a necessary defense against the dangerous influence of those multitudes without property and without principle with which our country, like all others, will in time abound. As to the unpopularity of the innovation, it was, in his opinion, chimerical.
Yeah, so you know what that is? So it's like something that changes, you know, it's kind of like a, how a lizard or certain animals can change their colors, like an octopus. They can, you know, change with a camouflage, you know, this changing, okay?
The great mass of our citizens is composed at this time of freeholders and will be pleased with it.
Okay, so Mr. Ellsworth.
Mr. Ellsworth, how shall the freehold be defined? Ought not every man who pays a tax to vote for the representative who is to levy and dispose of his money? Shall the wealthy merchants and manufacturers who will bear a full share of the public burdens be not allowed a voice in the imposition of them? Taxation and representation ought to go together.
Okay, so this goes down this path. I've said this before, that I believe when it comes down to representation, everybody should have a shot, or everybody should have, you know, be able to vote for their representative from the federal. Now, when we say representative, that means in the House of Representatives, at the federal, the state, and the county. All these other positions, we really should either be using electors, and or the, you know, the seat of government should be choosing the representative that would be in that that next government's up Senate. So the county should be choosing, the county legislators should be choosing who should be your senators, not we the people. Because their suffrage should be, you know, what's all considered. I mean, that's the whole point of protecting the suffrage of the state in the U.S. Senate. The same thing with the county in the state Senate. And it would be the same thing in the county Senate if the county happened to be that large or that immense in population that would require it. Because it's about checks and balances. So the only people that we would actually choose would be the representatives in our government that would be representing us. And in some cases, in some counties, you would be picking a district representative because your county's that big, right? So you'd pick your commissioner for that district. And then you'd also be having a district and or possibly, actually you wouldn't have a commissioner for the district. It'd be a commissioner that would be representing a group of districts, right? Because eventually when you want to make it to a point where you don't get 60, 100, you know, representatives of the county where you try kind of creating your own little Congress. Mm-hmm. When you have a city like LA with 13 million people, they have a right to fair representation. And so the idea of saying, well, you're only going to have five county commissioners that's going to represent you, that should not be palatable to anybody. So we have to, this is what I'm saying. And I keep on, you know, haranguing, harping. When we talk about representation, we need to understand the importance of having proper representation and ensuring that every government can self-sustain itself. It is a travesty that we go off and create a government that can't fund itself because the people itself can't afford it. And then next thing you know, the state or other governments and other people are subsidizing your government because you wanted to have a government when, you know, there was no need for it. Anyway, okay, so now Mr. Governor Morris pipes up. Go ahead.
Mr. Governor Morris, he had long learned not to be the dupe of words. The sound of aristocracy, therefore, had no effect on him. It was the thing, not the name, to which he was opposed. And one of his principal objections to the Constitution, as it is now before us, is that it threatens this. Country with an aristocracy, the aristocracy will grow out of the House of Representatives. Give the votes to the people who have no property, and they will sell them to the rich who will be able to buy them. We should not confine our attention to the present moment. The time is not distant when this country will abound with mechanics and manufacturers who will receive their bread from their employers. Will such men be the secure and faithful guardians of liberty? Will they be the impregnable barrier against aristocracy? He was as little duped by the association of the words taxation and representation. The man who does not give his vote freely is not represented. It is the man who dictates the vote. Children do not vote. Why? Because they want prudence. Because they have no will of their own. The ignorant and the dependent can be as little trusted with the public interest. He did not conceive the difficulty of divining freeholders to be insuperable. Still less that the restriction could be unpopular. 9/10 of the people are at present freeholders, and these will certainly be pleased with it. As to merchants and
et cetera.
Okay, as to merchants and et cetera, if they have wealth and value, the right they can acquire it. If not, they don't deserve it.
Okay. So, as we kind of see what Mr. Morris was laying out, I think he was making a very good point. And he was actually pointing out how we are today. We see this all over the place with ballot harvesting. In other words, somebody comes along and pays you for your ballot so that they can have your vote. That right there should actually be against the law. Ballot harvesting, if you don't want to vote, if you cannot vote on your own and you want to just sell it so that you can make money, you should not be able to do that because what that ends up happening. So the Supreme Court in the 1960s came up with the principle, one man, one vote. And the ballot harvesting is a direct violation of that principle, which technically what they implemented was completely unconstitutional because what they did was they implemented democracy in every state. But the principle or the concept that only one person should have the ability to vote or actually write what's going to, you know, choose for themselves. When somebody can come along and harvest ballots and basically amass hundreds, if not thousands, of votes for their one selfish desire, or, you know, for their party's political desire, because that's how it's happening today. That right there is an injustice and a travesty that should never happen in a Republican form of government. Allowing somebody by chance, because they can go out and harvest votes, giving them more political power to choose who the next representatives are going to be, who's the next president, and so forth. Absolutely unjust and a travesty. And it should be against the law. Ballot harvesting must be against the law. And the fact is that the courts are even allowing this. This shows you how they speak out of both sides of their mouth. And if you really notice, because it happens so fast when those jurists do that, this tongue, this forked tongue, dashes out and you know, flips itself at you, but you can't see it. It happens so fast. I'm just, you know, forked tongue. They're, you mm-hmm. know, they're reptilian, you know, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Just having fun at the jurist's expense. But the problem is that so many of the jurists have actually been, you know, doing these things that are absolutely an insurgency against the Constitution. This is how they're creating a democracy. In this particular case, they called it an aristocracy.
Yeah.
Because these people, these parties, or the players that can do this, can amass votes. And this is this should never be happening here. Anyway, okay, let's go down, keep going through the property and land with Colonel Mason. And then Madison, and I know he's going to have something good to say. Go ahead.
Colonel Mason, we all feel too strongly the remains of ancient prejudices and view things too much through a British medium. Freehold is the qualification in England, and hence it is imagined to be the only proper one. The true idea, in his opinion, was that every man having evidence of attachment to and permanent common interest with the society ought to share in all its rights and privileges. Was this qualification restrained to freeholders? Does no other kind of property but land evidence a common interest in the proprietor? Does nothing besides property mark a permanent attachment? Ought the merchant, the moneyed man, the parent of a number of children whose fortunes are to be pursued in his own country, to be viewed as suspicious characters and unworthy to be trusted with the common rights of their fellow citizens?
All good points. So Mason was a very interesting character, because when you read everything he says here, he's making very good arguments and articulating these principles that are really illuminating these issues. When we get into the ratification debates, he becomes a drama queen.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all about what he wants, and it had more to do with the Bill of Rights and his involvement in the Bill of Rights. Because he was the author or the architect of the Virginia Bill of Rights in the Virginia Constitution of 1780-something. So anyway, now Mr. Madison, I mean,
he makes
pipes.
A good point, though, because, uh-huh. you know, it's like a Californian coming to Utah or Wyoming, trying to get away from California.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when they get here, they try to make it California again.
Yep, yep. So the problem isn't the fact that they can do it. The problem is that we have democracies instead of Republican forms of government. The only reason California became the way it became is because it was running on a democracy. The only way that your state can actually be changed into a California is if you allow a democracy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? If you're living and if you're fulfilling a constitutional republic, then your government cannot do things because they voted to do it.
It must be enumerated. It must be within the Constitution, within their powers. Not because it's within their designs and desires. And as long as they vote and agree, they'll do it. We don't have to stand for this stuff. I just heard about, and I spoke about this last week on Friday. There's a man and a woman in Iowa that were basically criminalized because of how they were basically surviving in milking their cows and so forth. They were actually arrested by their county sheriff. And how they're actually created these laws that, you know, could regulate your ability to live. This is, you know, if you're going to milk cows for yourself, not to selling, but for yourself, you have to do these. You have to be licensed. Are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm.
That right there, those types of regulations and laws, one, they're not in their constitution. And then two, these are direct violations of our Ninth Amendment right. No enumeration in any constitution can be basically construed to disparage these rights that are, retained by the people. Your right to be able to do what you want with your property on your land to sustain yourself is your right.
Like chickens.
Whether it's chickens, whether it's milk and cows, it doesn't matter. And the fact that they're getting away with incarcerating people in Iowa.
See, yeah.
Anyway, let's go into what Madison says. Go ahead. Actually, we got 1 minute left. So anything you want to add before we dive into this for tomorrow?
Nope. I just think it's interesting how it just unfolds. And their arguments are brilliant back and forth. And how they eventually come into the brilliance of the Constitution.
Right. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever been involved in debates. You probably have. And there's been many times as a parent, there's no doubt in my mind, you feel you become overcome. You become constrained, possessed by a spirit that, you know, your child is doing something or saying something that is absolutely wrong. That you become so overwhelmed that you have to rebuke your child to help them understand, you know, the unrighteousness of what they're saying or the things that they're, you know, spewing is wrong. And in other words, the divine hand of providence and that inspiration via what I would call revelation, because it's something that's being testified in your heart, in your spirit, in your mind, mm-hmm. in your mind's eye. And you go, wow, how this is. And when you're hearing these things, it strikes to the next person and it goes to the next person and it goes. And this is how the divine hand of providence was literally working. And fortunately, they one had the time and they had the ear and the mind's eye to see and listen to these promptings so that they could get more correct with the principles of liberty. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.